Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have joining with us from west of Denver in Colorado, Mr. Philip Yancey. Philip, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
Now, I have a great sense of obligation to make this a very good interview and to make people go out and buy a copy of your new book, Vanishing Grace, or something from your backlog, because I don't think there is any other author in my dozen years of preaching that I have ripped off as much as I ripped off your stuff.
I'm sure you credited it each time.
The majority of times, at least.
Okay.
No, yeah, I've loved your stuff. It's been great. I'm assuming there are a lot of preachers who have used a lot of your stuff, so we are in debt to you.
Well, you're welcome to it. You guys are the ones on the front lines. I just sit in my basement office and play with these thoughts. You actually put them out there for the people, so thank you as well.
Well, as long as I'm preaching, I need you to be writing, so keep up the good work.
You keep what you're doing, I'll keep what I'm doing.
fair trade. Now, one of the things that I've seen in your books is that it seems like there are two issues that you always kind of circle back to, the issue of suffering and the issue of grace. Would it be fair to say those are kind of like two issues which you're always wanting to deal with?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the other day, somebody tried to get me to pin down a lecture, and I came up with the title, Two Themes That Haunt Me. And those are the themes, suffering and grace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, what is it about those two things that are so riveting to you?
A lot of it is explained by my background. I grew up in an unhealthy church. I've written about that.
Yep.
And it took me quite some time to recover from what the church did to the gospel. This was one of these narrow, fundamentalist, racist, angry churches in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first experienced and encountered grace, it was amazing. The song goes, it was just a gulp of fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to convey that to others, both who are trapped in a church like that, but even more importantly, as I get into in this book, to the world outside, many of whom judge Christians by those kinds of churches. So that's one theme. The other theme of suffering also comes out of my childhood, I think, because when I was just a year old, my father, he was planning to go to Africa as a missionary, came down with polio, was paralyzed, and people in the church believed that he would be healed.
Mm.
So against medical advice, they had him removed from an iron lung, and he soon died. So what I learned early on is what you believe about things makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And especially on this issue of suffering, what we believe, what we practice as Christians toward suffering people makes a huge difference. And over the years, I have spent a lot of time in crisis situations with people who have gone through traumatic times, and I've learned a few things from them about what the church can do that helps and what the church often does that does not help.
Yeah. What are some things that doesn't help?
One pretty simple thing that is an error we all tend to make is we talk too much. Go back to the book of Job. We talk about Job's comforters, mm-hmm. and that's always in quotes because they really didn't offer him comfort. They made it harder for him. But if you go back and read that story carefully, the first 7 days they came, they didn't say a word. They sat there, tore their clothes, covered their head with ashes, and just sat with him as a friend. It's when they open their mouths that the problem started.
Yeah.
And Christians, understandably, often well-intentioned, come up with these flip explanations. God, you must have done something wrong. God is punishing you. No, no, it's not God. It's the devil. The devil's attacking you. No, it's not the devil. It's God, but not because he's punishing you. He's especially selected you to be an example to others. You know, we come up with those kind of explanations, and they don't really help. And again and again, we end up doing more harm than good in some cases.
Why do you think that we have such a propensity to go towards those flippant answers when people are suffering instead of choosing to be quiet?
I think we're nervous. We feel bad. We want to fix it. We want it to be better. So we just naturally say the first things that come to our mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes even at funerals, a child. You come up and if a child dies, and people will often say to the parents, I've heard this from many parents, well, that's sad, but God needed a little flower in heaven, and, mm-hmm. and at least you have another daughter back home. That doesn't really help when you're burying the child that you also loved. So we just need to be much more careful, much more sensitive before we open our mouths.
Are those some of the things that you heard when your father passed away? Obviously not a, you know, a little daughter, but when your dad passed away, was that kind of some of the rhetoric that people were using to you?
Well, I was only 1 year old, I don't remember much of that.
That, yes.
But actually, as I grew up a little bit, I would hear those kinds of explanations, yes.
Yeah. So if people are kind of speaking out of a nervous, anxious presence, and so they say these flippant things, what are the ways that, you know, we learn to be okay and not nervous and not anxious in other people's suffering?
It's a matter of how do we love people. Hmm. And some people do want dialogue. They do want debate. I found that actually not very many. Most people who are going through suffering aren't sitting around thinking about theodicy and the problem of pain. They're thinking about, man, it hurts. I want to stop hurting, you know.
Yeah.
And so when I ask who helps, they'll talk about a grandmother who just sits by their side knitting. But when they need a nurse or when they need a cup of water, there she is to go get it.
Yeah. You have this line about pain works at a different level than beauty. It distills life. It adds urgency. And I think that's definitely true. When you talk about elsewhere how the shallow celebrity culture loses its appeal when your 3-year-old is dying in the hospital. And I think you're really speaking to the propensity that adversity and suffering has to point you towards faith. But one of my bigger questions is not, does it point us towards faith and longing for that? Because we all know the old platitude that there are no atheists in foxholes, and the bargaining with God seems to happen in adversity. But does that longing for faith in adversity confirm faith's existence and its usefulness, or is it just an example of how faith is really wish fulfillment? Like, we want something to get us through adversity, but that doesn't mean it's legitimate.
A lot of people get confused about faith. One of the helpful metaphors to me is a scene in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, actually, of Jacob wrestling with the angel. He wrestles all night long, and at the end, the angel says, let me go. Jacob says, I'm not going to let you go until you give me the blessing. So there are several things at work there. For one thing, Jacob doesn't let go. He wrestles all night long.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when we go through adversity, it feels like that. It feels like we're just wrestling all night long. The other thing is, don't let go until you get the blessing. There will be, we have the promises, not that we won't experience pain and suffering, we do, but it will somehow be redemptive, that God can grow something good out of it. So if you go to the New Testament passages on pain and suffering in James 1, 1 Peter 1, Romans 5, every one of them emphasizes what can be produced from those hard times. Patience, perseverance, hope. It just spells out, not that you won't go through things, but they're not worthless pains. You can get something out of them. And then the last lesson I learned from that scene of Jacob is that, yeah, he got the blessing, but he also limped the rest of his life.
Yeah.
You know? And for Christians, often those wounds don't go away. If you lose a child, for example, you're not going to get over it.
No,
it will be there all the rest of your life. God can work good in it. God can do a lot of healing, but that hole is still there, and there's no platitude that's going to take that away.
Yeah. I have a friend who lost a daughter, and he talks about afterwards, it's not that the next grief and the next adversity goes through adds to it, but it multiplies. And so, like, there's this exponential effect of suffering and adversity that it's just, you always deal with it. It's always going to be part of it.
Right.
And we see examples of people who do what, you know, James and Romans talk about with, you know, your endurance is creating character is given because of going through these things. But still, I wonder, is our longing for faith in God and something existential in our adversity really a sign that it exists? Or is it true, like what Freud and some other critics of faith have said, that it's just, well, you know, faith is just wish fulfillment, and we want that to be there during our adversity?
Well, let me let me speak to that in another way. In December of 2012, I was called by a friend of mine in Newtown, Connecticut, and they asked me to come speak on Where Is God When It Hurts to that town that had just absorbed the terrible tragedy of 20 of their school children being shot by a gunman as they were in class. And I happened to be reading some books by the new atheists, people like Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, for an article I was working on. And I was reading things like, we live in a universe of randomness, life just like the planet will flare out like a match. We're an accident of the universe. We live in a universe of blind, pitiless indifference. And as I thought through what I would say to them, I thought, that wouldn't really offer any words of comfort or hope. If those atheists were called to speak to Newtown, what would they say? Okay, you lost your kid. Get used to it. You're never going to see him again. The whole thing was an accident to begin with.
Yeah.
And even the New York Times at a time like that, or 9/11, a time of national tragedy, what do? They turn to priests and rabbis and pastors because we need that. We desperately want that comfort and hope. And I could stand in front of the parents and the first responders and say, I know where these children are because Jesus said before he left, I'm going away to prepare a place for you and suffer the little children to come to me. So we have a resurrection faith. And, you know, somebody like Freud or people like that or the new atheists could stand in front of the people and say, well, it's just wish fulfillment. But when you've just experience what they have experienced, you cling to whatever offers comfort. And I'll let the apologetics people establish the proofs for the resurrection of Jesus and all that. You know, there are people who are very good at that. But I do know that if you're standing in front of these parents, the message of hopelessness isn't enough. They are longing desperately for some belief that there is justice in the universe, that they will one day be reunited with their child. That's a deep, powerful instinct. And the apologetics people, again, can look at the Bible and try to prove its historic merit and all of that kind of stuff. But I must say, having been in those existential situations, it makes a huge difference to the people going through adversity.
Yeah, but I love the stuff you've done with that, with the, you know, going to different places of grief, and like you talked about that, the pastor typically gets called into that moment, and the pastor's called in to speak a word and to make sense of that. And in this book, you talk about Henry Nouwen's experience when he went to South America. And he said one of the things that he learned from that is that the desire to save, you know, whether it's from, you know, sin or poverty or exploitation, can be one of the most damaging motives in ministry, which he was very counterintuitive because, you know, when a pastor gets called into those moments, they do want to bring a word of hope and save them from the hurt and the suffering. But why do you think Nouwen was saying that that desire can be one of the most damaging motives in ministry?
In the book, I identify several kinds of what I call grace dispensers. Those are people who are especially good at dispensing grace in an increasingly hostile world. And pilgrims is one word that I use. It's one of the three categories, activists, artists, and pilgrims. Mm-hmm. Henry Nouwen learned that there are some things that a priest can do and there are some things a priest can't do. What happens is the priest sets up this kind of hierarchy. Okay, I know the truth. I'm going to reach down and help you. And that has its limits. There are times when that's useful if you're doing the sacraments or baptizing or whatever. But there are other times when a person needs a companion, a fellow pilgrim. And that's something that every one of us can do. Because when you talk to people about what they don't like about Christians, they use words like, well, they think they're so superior, they think they're so self-righteous. Mm-hmm. And of all people on earth, we know we're not self-righteous. We have no righteousness out of ourselves. It comes from God. And if we convey that we're some sort of upper super class of Christians, of human beings that are better than you, people aren't going to be open to our message. They're not going to receive grace. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they perceive, look, we're all in this confusing world. We're trying to navigate our way through. But those people seem to know where they're going. They have a destination in mind. We're all pilgrims, but they know where they're going. If we can convey that, then we can communicate the good news to people who might not listen to it. We certainly wouldn't go to a church and listen to an authority figure, a pastor or a priest, talking down to them.
Yeah. Well, why do you think those three people, the pilgrim, the activist, and the artist, are the three that still garner respect from outside the Christian community? What happened to the priest? Why isn't the deacon, why isn't the elder still having a place of respect in the culture outside of Christianity?
You can read books by Gabe Lyons, people like that, that are based on the research done by the Barna surveys, and they describe what's happened. Part of it has to do with the media. The media loves to stereotype. They love to take some of the strangest examples of what we believe and focus on scandals and media evangelists who squander money and rip off old people, you know, the whole story there. Yeah. That's part of it. And then it's true that we Christians haven't really adjusted, I think, to the changes going on in our culture. We got spoiled by the Christian consensus in the United States, which is, it's really the outlier in most of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly the outlier of what was happening in the New Testament. The Roman Empire, the culture that Jesus and Paul faced, was far more brutal and far more hostile to faith than anything you see in the United States today. But as things have changed, a lot of Christians grow fearful, they grow resentful, and they want to strike back. And so that's exactly what I'm addressing. Some of it is stereotypes, some of it is our behavior, and I'm trying to recall us to a mission that I found very well expressed in a verse in Hebrews 12:15. It goes like this: see to it that no one misses the grace of God. And that's something that we can get our minds around and do. We can't see to it that everybody in the world is going to be converted. Some people choose not to. Jesus knew that. Paul knew that. We can't see to it that we get the United States back the way we like it. Those are days in the past. But we can see to it that no one misses the grace of God. And that's a calling that I want the church to attend to.
Yeah. I wonder what the person who hears that and they think, well, just because Christianity doesn't do well in polls anymore doesn't make a difference because, you know, as Paul says, to those outsiders, to those perishing, the message of, you know, the cross is foolishness. And they hear, okay, well, Barna says that, you know, we're not seen very well in our popular culture. So why should we really care if we're called to be set apart and we're called to, you know, not win popularity contests?
You're absolutely right. We're not called to win a popularity contest. We are called to dispense the good news of forgiveness and God's love. And if there's something that we're doing that makes people see our message as bad news rather than good news, that's a travesty. That's a tragedy. Jesus was a master at hanging around people who were morally offensive. They had to be morally offensive to him. He was always accused of consorting with the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the sinners, you know. And yet somehow they were attracted to him. It was the uptight religious people who were threatened by him. He had an ability to do that, to awaken the thirst. Now, there are a lot of people in our society today who think, I'm doing just fine, thank you. I've got the latest iPhone, and I've got Netflix stream. I can just sit here and drink a glass of wine, watch movies. What a great life that is. But every once in a while, at what I call hinge moments, the birth of a child, the death of a relative, Alzheimer's disease, a wedding, that person thinks, well, maybe there's something more here. Maybe I need something more. Is there life after death? You know, some of those great questions that we can go through life denying until those hinge moments happen. Jesus was a master at being sensitive to those hinge moments and then pulling them out even when the person wasn't immediately aware of them.
Yeah. So when we're talking to someone in these hinge moments, obviously our conversation today has to be different. And I love the C.S. Lewis analogy you used in the book, in which C.S. Lewis compared the difference in courting a divorcee and a virgin.
Right.
Which I think that's brilliant. Like, I've been married, you know, over a decade now. And I can't imagine going back to dating, because I feel like if you date, like, you have to believe kind of the BS that you say, like, I'm always going to make you happy and we're never going to have a bad day together. But after a decade, you realize that's not reality. And in some ways, like, evangelism, in like the naive evangelism where it says, you know, you're one prayer away from always being happy. Like, that's really nice. It's kind of like the 20-year-old who's flirting with a girl trying to get her to go on a date with him. It's nice, but it's naive and unrealistic. And I think you push back against, I think it was the Campus Crusades, maybe their overly simplified kind of pitch that they give people to come to faith. But that obviously doesn't work. And so, just as C.S. Lewis was touching on, in a, you know, a secular Britain, how do we communicate to the people in the hinge moments the good news of grace, now that they're not naive to the message? They've heard the naive message. What do we tell them now?
Yes, you're right. And I travel internationally, and I go to places where the gospel is being received by virgins. You know, they've not heard it, and they hear, wow, there's a God. God actually loves me. There's a life after death. Wow, this is great, mm-hmm. you know? And yet here in the West and in the United States increasingly, the response is like a divorcee. Yeah, right, I've heard all that stuff before, and it just doesn't work, you know? I mean, I've seen some Christians, and they're no better than anybody else. You hear these responses, these arguments. One thing that was very helpful to me, Luke, is a phrase that I heard from Miroslav Volf. Miroslav Volf came from Croatia. Mm-hmm. And that was a religious sparked war there, so he knew some of the problems that religion can cause. And then he became a theologian, first at Fuller Theological Seminary and then at Yale Divinity School. And he said that we need to adjust, because in the old days you could communicate your faith in a way that he called head to head. So I believe something, let me tell you about it, then you can believe it too. I'm going to convince you of the truth of what I believe. He says that doesn't work so well anymore. In the old days, Billy Graham could come to a city, rent the biggest stadium, fill it with 100,000 people, stand up there and say, "The Bible says," and they all say, "Oh, well, it must be true," and they respond. They try doing that today, and it's changed. You wouldn't get 100,000 people, probably.
No.
And if you stood up there and said, "The Bible says," a lot of people would be sitting there thinking, "Well, so what? I don't believe the Bible. You know, the Koran says something different. Why should I believe him?"
Mm-hmm.
And Volf says the most effective way in that kind of divorcee culture, as it were, is what he calls hand to heart to head. So that you reach out with works of mercy, undeniable works of mercy. I'm rebuilding your house that was just destroyed in a hurricane. I'm sitting by your family at a hospice. And, you know, the church has all of these programs going. And when I do that, effectively, it touches the heart. Why are you doing this? Why do you care about me? And then the people are open. It is a hinge moment. The people are open to that head talk. Well, I'll tell you why. Because God has given me grace. God loves me. And he's commanded us to go and spread that love to others who may not know about it. That's a different paradigm, more difficult, requires more patience, but in a changing culture, it's much more effective than, say, standing on a street corner, passing out tracts, or on a soapbox talking.
Yeah, that's good. What is Volf's phrase? It's sharing God's wisdom, right? Isn't that how he describes
it? That's correct. Yeah, sharing God's wisdom, because a lot of people think that they see Christians as uptight. They don't know how to have fun. You know, they don't. The world should be full of sex and booze and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah, of course.
And these Christians are against that kind of stuff, and indeed we are in some ways. But sharing God's wisdom indicates we actually know the best way to live, the best for us. And I spent some time on that in the book, because I grew up thinking that God was trying to keep me from having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Now I believe God was trying to keep me from hurting myself. It's when we step out of the life that he designed for us that we hurt ourselves more than anybody else.
Yeah, Now, you talk about Keller's take on evangelism and his critique of friendship evangelism. And he says, just call it friendship. That's it. And, you know, I planted a church. I am planting a church that's about 5 years old outside of Dallas down here in Texas. Uh-huh. And one of the things I found when I started planting a church is that, you know, you start with money in the bank from, you know, mother church, and then you've got a declining balance. And so you've got to get people in the door to fill seats. You've got to give people who write checks. You got to get people who volunteer. And soon you hear all the phrases about how evangelism happens so effectively in church plants. But what you don't hear is the commodification of friendships that happens when you need people to fill roles and need people to do stuff. And
that's a great phrase.
And
yeah.
I don't know if it's actually a word or not, but thank you. I'll take that. You're a good writer, so you say it works. But like, we don't talk about how even in a traditional church or whatever, where we're given like the pats on the back when we bring someone to church, and when one of our friends shows up, there's a sense of, oh yeah, I did what we're supposed to do, and so we kind of lose that sense of just being friends, and people in some ways become ways for us to be benefited and rewarded. And that's one of the toughest things about evangelism, is that I just want to have, like your phrase, grace on tap. I just want to give grace to people instead of doing this. How do we stick with that grace on tap thing?
Boy, that's a great question. And part of it is we're a marketing culture. And so all day long, we are barraged with messages from people trying to sell us something, people trying to talk us into changing our lives in this way, that way, the other way. And how do we do it? Again, I go back to Jesus, because he was so un-American in the way he ran his life. He never, from what I could see, went by this Microsoft Windows calendar. You know, these are the 14 things I have to do today. I mean, I do that. I turn on the computer and it tells me what to do today.
Yeah.
Jesus just kind of wandered through towns, and if there's a VIP luncheon but a blind beggar calls out to him, guess which gets a priority? He stops the parade. He goes over and deals with the beggar. And all the way through the Gospels, Jesus puts people first. The one time, specific time, one of the times it says Jesus loved him, was a person who walked away rejecting his message. That was the rich young ruler. He said, what do I have to do to get eternal life? And Jesus explained. He said, boy, that's too hard. And he walks away. And Mark adds, and Jesus loved him. Not, and Jesus scratched him off because, he rejected me. But it's a whole different way of relating to people who reject us. We are not here to fulfill our list of goal-oriented tasks. We are here to express God's love for the least likely people. And the more we understand how God did that for us, the more we'll be motivated to do the same thing for others. That's what I call grace dispensers.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let me ask you some questions about, or a question about art. You talk about, you know, the artist being one of the people that is still respected by outsiders. And you have a quote from Ratzinger, who obviously became Pope Benedict, but you know, he talks about the two things that the church really has as her arguments: the saints the church produces, and the art which has grown in her womb. So, why is art such a great witness for church?
Several reasons. One, it summons up beauty, and when I look at the world, the most obvious thing about it is that God is a great artist. I live in the Rocky Mountains. I could talk about forever. But wherever you go, whether you're diving in the Great Barrier Reef or some remote mountain in Colorado, you see beauty, wildflowers, tropical fish. So we are, in a sense, sub-creators, many creators who are reflecting something of what God is like. That's part of the image of God in us, I believe.
Yeah.
But more to the point in this book is that art also communicates at a different level. So people who may never go to a church and may be resistant to, you know, they'd never read a book like Mere Christianity, Here's Why You Should Believe, yet art has a way of sneaking inside, of summoning up that thirst. I talked about awakening thirst, and art can do that sometimes even negatively, so that some of the authors who are working today are the best expositors of original sin because they show how decadent our culture is.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just that they don't have the answer. You know, they don't have a solution for it. And true art will do that. It just reflects reality. And if we believe what we believe as Christians is reality, then the best way to express that is through art.
Okay, so if art is a signpost that's pointing us, it communicates something, you know, transcendent, then why is there so much bad art in church? How come we miss that? I mean, it's such a big part of God. God's a great artist. We're imitating him. How come there's, like, just some really bad art in church?
Well, go to any art museum in the world, and you see it hasn't always been true.
Yeah.
Because Raphael, Leonardo, Da Vinci, Michelangelo, you know, they were all out of the womb. That's exactly what Ratzinger was saying. It's the womb of the church that produced this great art. What's happened, I think, is that artists are, they're weird. They're hard to work with. They're like cats, you know? You can't control them.
Yeah.
And they look weird. I don't want to paint with a brush because in some of the art, for instance, music, I think that the church in America has been on the cutting edge. You watch The Voice or America's Got Talent, and most of them came out of the church. You know, that's where that's where music is fostered, and Christian music is top notch. It's professional. In other areas, paintings, not so much. Drama, well, we tend to be a little more propagandistic than the world is really open to right now. So a 5-minute sketch in church may work, but we're not producing, you know, the great plays that win Pulitzer Prizes.
Right.
Yeah, I literature, I talk about how, you know, the church makes it difficult for artists because it's always trying to put boxes around them, and artists don't like boxes around them. So it's a complicated thing, and I don't want to paint using an artistic metaphor. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. But I do call the church back to recognize the impressive role of artists historically, and especially in a culture that's moving away and more resistant to the kind of direct message that we're used to.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, Phil, thank you so much for your time. I've enjoyed talking with you about Vanishing Grace and some of the other stuff that we've discussed, but I appreciate your work, and you've got to keep writing as long as I'm keep preaching.
I'll do it. I'll get back to it right now.
Outstanding. All right, well, thanks for your time, Phil.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.